And we're live. It's Sunday. It is the main course. This is the Heritage Radio Network. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, today, and my co-host, Patrick Martins, is off in Texas doing what Heritage Foods USA business he needs to do down there. Today, we have a really tremendous show lined up. The first guest we'll be having on is Peter Pringle, who is a world-renowned journalist from Britain who lives in New York City. He was the author of Food Incorporated, but today we're going to talk about a more recent book, The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov, which I got interested in after reading the obituary of Norman Borlaug, who was sort of the American counterpart. Vavilov was really the father of seed conservation in the Soviet Union and had hoped to end world famine, not just in the Soviet Union, but around the world, and worked tirelessly to promote plant genetics and seed conservation, and was ultimately brought down by the apparatchiks of the NKVD and Stalin himself, as well as dissent amongst the scientists in the Soviet Union. It was a big power grab. So it's a fascinating subject. Peter Pringle will be on with us in a couple of minutes. And after Mr. Pringle, we will have David Grotenstein on from the director of operations from the Garden of Eden, which is another small supermarket chain in New York City that has started up maybe about 5-6 years ago. 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
No way. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. I never noticed them until, I don't know.
I know.
But anyway,
best kept secret.
Yeah, exactly. So we're continuing our little exploration of food chains in New York. We had Anna Zoitas on from West Side Market a few weeks ago, and now we have David to follow Mr. Pringle. So, Jack, why don't we dial up Peter Pringle, and I will read his fabulous biography in the meantime. And then we'll go from there. So for those of you who are not familiar with him, Peter Pringle is the author or co-author of 9 previous books, including Food Incorporated, which was a New York Times notable book, the best-selling Those Are Real Bullets, and most recently, a novel, Day of the Dandelion. He was the foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times in London and The Observer, and a former Moscow bureau chief for The Independent, again, a British paper. He has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, The New Republic, and The Nation. So we are truly honored to have Mr. Pringle join us today on the main course. Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, how excellent.
I'm hobbling about.
Are you hobbling? Did you get a cast?
No, I didn't get a cast. They wrapped it up in...
In gauze and tissue?
Christmas paper.
Yes, that's right, with a nice big red bow on the side
that's
saying,
right.
Do not walk.
That's right.
Uh-oh, I'm sorry.
It's pathetic. The whole thing is pathetic.
Well, I'm hoping you will heal up soon so that you can carry on with your important work.
Yes, well, what? Whatever.
Well, whatever. But, I mean, you're always you're a busy guy, Mr. Pringle. You
no,
got a
I'm
lot
not.
Of projects going on.
No, yesterday's man, you know.
I don't think so. certainly not after the success of Food Incorporated. And now, today we're going to be talking about your most recent book, The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov, which came out when, in July?
It came out last year in May, I think.
Last year in May.
Last summer.
And because you had been the bureau chief in Moscow, was that how you got interested in Nikolai Vavilov's story?
Yeah. Can I just ask you, is this live or is this recorded? Or?
This is live and recorded.
And recorded.
Yes. So actually, you can tell people to tune in if they go on the internet to www.heritageradionetwork.com.
Great.
Scroll to the main course, hit the Listen Live button in the top right corner of their screen. Then they can listen to you as everybody else is. And then you can download it later on and add it to your website or whatever you want to do. It
okay.
can be done as a podcast as well.
Okay.
So, and your name will be in our tag cloud. We okay. have a tag cloud. So
wow.
that means that if people click on that name, it will come up to your segment.
Oh, no, it's, how wonderful.
It's just incredible. I mean, I'm too old to really understand how any of this works, but my engineering friends in the studio here, Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener, they know all about this stuff.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Which is a good thing, because if it was up to me, no, this would not happen.
This is true.
Anyway, so tell me, just to start, what got you interested in Nikolai Vavilov's story, which indeed is really a tragic one?
Well, you know, I was a correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent in in Moscow, and I lived on a street named after Lenin's brother, Dmitry Ulyanov, and next, crossing that street, was a street called Vavilov Street.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. What is Vavilov? Who is Vavilov? You know, and all the rest of it. And, of course, most of the streets in Moscow around where I lived were named after famous communists and some foreigners like Ho Chi Minh. And, but many of the names meant absolutely nothing to me.
Sure.
So one day I said to my friend, I said, who is this Vavilov? So she said, well, actually it's named after Sergei Vavilov, who was president of the Academy of Sciences under Stalin. But his brother, Nikolai, who was a geneticist, a much more famous person, and unfortunately, Stalin hated Nikolai and all the bourgeois geneticists, and so he arrested them and imprisoned them and actually executed many of them.
Yes.
And so that's how I got interested in it. And I said, well, and she said, you know, he's terribly famous. He tried to feed the world. I said, what are you talking about, feed the world? What year are we talking about? So she said, well, about 1920s, 1930s, something like that. So I said, how could he possibly have done that? And so she said, well, he was a geneticist, very early geneticist, and he went on all these wonderful expeditions all over the world. He went to, you know, the Fertile Crescent, now Iraq and Syria. He went to the North African coast. He went to Ethiopia, which was then called Abyssinia. Mm-hmm. He went to Mexico.
Afghanistan, fascinated by that chapter.
South America, all over the place,
yeah.
Collecting these wild seeds to train them or to insert them, not in a biotech way, but to breed them into the staple crop plants.
In the Soviet Union?
Well, in the Soviet Union, but his idea was for the whole world. You know,
yes.
What's the problem? You go over there into these countries and you collect these seeds, you bring them back, you start a seed bank, which he did.
Yes.
A fantastic seed bank in St. Petersburg, the first collection of crop seeds anywhere in the world. Eventually he had 250,000 seeds there by mm-hmm. the end of the 30s.
Yes.
And this was to become the envy of plant breeders everywhere.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, as the book progresses, it explains sort of the fundamental difference between his ideas about plant breeding and genetics and those of his arch rival, Trofim Lysenko. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind explaining that a little more clearly so that people can understand why this guy went off the rails with the regime and what the consequences of it were. I know there was the controversy between Mendel and
sure.
Lamarck. So
sure.
let's start with that. And
Well, originally Mendel, he figured out how genes worked. He didn't know they were called genes, but he figured out by crossing his peas in his monastery garden that you could come up with the genes. Sometimes they skipped a generation, sometimes they appeared in the next, sometimes they... Anyway, when they mixed up, there was a mix, and so he figured out that he could breed peas and he could make them have yellow flowers or blue flowers or whatever, different ones, by selecting them out.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote his essay, and that lay dormant for about 30 years because people, including Darwin, just simply didn't get around to reading it. Sort of one
wow.
of the great holes in history.
Incredible.
And anyway, around the turn of the century, people started reading again and said, okay, fine, this looks great. So if we want to breed better corn plants or wheat plants or tomatoes or whatever you want, you have to select the good, the fine ones, and then you breed those out. And that's what Vavilov decided to do. Let's call him Nikolai, shall we?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. So he decided that's what you could do. So this was a new idea at the time. This was something that you could go and you could find all the genes. For example, in Ethiopia or something, he might find a wheat plant that withstood drought. So he would take that plant back to Russia, breed it to a plant that commonly has lots of water. Then if there was a drought that year, that wheat plant might withstand that drought.
Yes.
So it was a great breeding thing. Now, the other way to look at that, the other idea was the Lamarckian idea, which was that you would plants and everybody else, for that matter, frogs, people, you know, would pick up particular characteristics during their lifetime. For example, if your son was a boxer and he got huge muscles, then it would be passed on to his progeny. Not true.
Right.
But it was a clever trick for this Lysenko fella to go up against Nikolai. And Lysenko said, no, wait a minute. Your way, Nikolai's way, takes about 12 years to breed these new genes into this plant to make it a sturdier plant or whatever. My way, I can do it just by talking to my plants and by...
And in one generation.
And it's one generation. Mm-hmm. So Stalin, if I may go on...
Please.
Stalin looked at this thing and said, oh, well, we've got a real problem here because we've got another famine.
Yeah.
Due to
the collectivization of the
farms. Mostly man-made, due to the collectivization, right. And so they're not producing, the peasants aren't producing enough food, so let's select Lysenko over Vavilov, mm-hmm. because Lysenko tells me he can do it in a year or 2 years or something mm-hmm. like that. And so he did. And so Vavilov, although he was much admired, had this great international following, went all over the world, tremendous energy, collected all these seeds, suddenly fell out of favor.
Yeah, well, it was as I read the book, I was struck again and again by, honestly, it would have been comical if it weren't so tragic. I mean, reading the incredible stupidity of these apparatchiks in terms of their confronting a scientist of the caliber of Vavilov, who was presenting all over the world and who had the backing of an international community of scientists, versus this fool.
Yes, that's right.
Lysenko.
Yes,
and his very dubious supporters, of which there were probably maybe three or four besides Stalin himself. But in the end, that was what carried the day, was his when Lysenko failed to produce these extra special crops,
right.
Why did he not fall out of favor? I didn't really kind of get that.
Well, the underlying thing about this is that, of course, Lenin knew in the 1920s, as soon as the revolution happened, 1917, whatever.
Yeah.
Lenin leads it for a bit. He dies in 1924. But he knew perfectly well that you couldn't go in there and execute all the old bourgeoisie, because that's where the educated classes were. That's where the expertise lay, exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you got rid of them, then you had no science, no education, no science and education, which was the big thing, mm-hmm. right? So you had to keep these guys on, like Vavilov, who came of the merchant class. He wasn't exactly a toff, but or an aristocrat, but he was his father, who had been himself, he'd been born into slavery at some point and to serfdom, but he got out of it. And in that sort of period between, over the 1900 period, he became one of the sort of first merchant class. So Vavilov, actually, Nikolai, grew up perfectly well off.
Yes.
His father was a textile manager in a factory in Moscow. Yeah.
Although eventually his father was purged as well and had to leave the country, right?
Didn't he have to go to Bulgaria or something to try to save his skin? That's right. They did go after that class, mm-hmm. and most of that class went to Europe in some way. Actually, Vavilov's father went to Bulgaria for unknown reasons, but he did. And he was a failure, and he came back and he died.
Just weeks after his return, apparently.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's very sad.
So the underlying thing was, Lenin accepted these guys, the red specialists, the bourgeois specialists, as he called them, said, okay, well, we'll keep them going, but we know perfectly well that they're against us, and eventually we'll have to get rid of them. So when Stalin took over from Lenin in 1925, he decided, he always had his eye on them, and he said, well, okay, come, 1929-30, with the big break from the West, as it were, we'll get rid of all these people, because these bourgeois specialists, because not only do they not really support us in their gut, but they might rise up against us. In any case, they're probably spies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the paranoia was just incredible.
That's right.
Absolutely amazing.
So poor old Nikolai was a victim of that.
Yes,
as well as being a victim of this ignorant choice of Lysenko over him as the person who should be in charge of Russian agriculture.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. I must say, you've told it so well because it reads like almost like a thriller in a way. I mean, it's not quite as gripping as, you know, I don't know, one of those sort of cheesy guys. But
you mean Dan Brown?
Yeah, right. But for an historical story, your research is phenomenal. And one of the questions I had, and I know David has a question for you too. But one of the biggest questions I had was, how did you get access to so many of his papers?
Well,
how were you able to get, you know, letters and notes and quotes from people who were his contemporaries and so forth?
Well, after Stalin fell and, there was in the 50s, there was a kind of, we must admit to Stalin's crimes. We must rehabilitate those who were victims of it. And so Nikolai was one of them. So he became a hero, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He has a son called Yuri,
yes,
who is still alive in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And if you are the direct relative of a person who was, interrogated, condemned to death, executed, put in prison, whatever, by the then KGB, you can have access to your files.
Oh, cool.
So Yuri got access to his files, and he very graciously shared them with me.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how we got the interrogation files from the KGB.
Yeah. And some of the exchanges between Nikolai and Lysenko were just breathtaking. I mean, incredible. But David, you wanted to ask something. We have David Grotenstein from my next guest in the studio, and so I can see he has
Hello,
a question.
David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I was just curious, because did Nikolai have any chance at all? It sounds like he was a victim of this, I want to say, class prejudice.
It was totally a class-based
And so if Lysenko had never emerged, let's say, might his work have come into play? And since it didn't, did it disappear, or did somebody else find his work and move on with it? Or?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, would he have had a chance if Lysenko hadn't been there or something? I think if Lysenko hadn't been there, somebody else would have taken Lysenko's place, because Stalin really needed a scapegoat for the
famines
that he had created through this collectivization process. So
Lysenko became kind of a quick fix and then a failure and a scapegoat.
That's correct. But he lived on. Lysenko lived on. Right. And actually, it was very, very difficult to teach, to study, to do anything with genetics until the 70s, when Lysenko died. And even after he died, they still were thinking, oh, poor Lysenko, some of his followers. You know, I mean, it was an unbelievable, untold event for Russian science.
It had incredibly far-reaching... Yeah, I was just going to say, the consequences went on and on.
Yeah.
One more question, or actually I have a million more questions, but another question I had was, by 1939, Americans had developed a hybrid corn with a really high yield.
Yeah.
And since that was before World War II, I was kind of wondering why that technology, as it were, was not shared with the Soviet Union. Was that because the Soviet Union refused to acknowledge, or the United States would not do business with them?
It was shared with the Soviet Union. In fact, many, many, many things were shared between the United States and the Soviet Union in the early days.
Uh-huh.
That was perfectly... Vavilov knew perfectly well about it. He tried to push it.
Yeah.
He tried to say, look, we should actually take a look at this thing. And Lysenko just overruled it. Said, no, this is bourgeois nonsense. You can't have it. You know?
Yeah, it's a capitalist conspiracy to gut the revolution.
Yeah.
It was amazing how much ideology played into the science. I was stunned by that, by how much it was about the bourgeois mentality versus the comrade mentality, and how much of an impact that had on both the persecution of Vavilov, but also the sort of overall health and well-being of the population.
Well, that's right. But you ask a very good question, because you have to think, if most of the and almost all of the academic events in Russia were you know, at the command of the Tsar, at the grace of the Tsar, he funded all this, the Academy of Sciences, he started it, all this sort of thing. So all the people who were in science at the time of the revolution were all those people who the revolution wanted to get rid of.
Yeah.
So when it came to, you know, what do you do about all this? They then started these communist universities. So you had to be a comrade, had to be a member of the party to go to these universities. And the idea, Lenin's idea, and then Stalin's idea was to create this cadre of red specialists, they called them, and as opposed to bourgeois specialists. And the red specialists were rushed through these universities with very little education and came out the other end with a politicized agenda, mm-hmm. which fitted in perfectly well with Lysenko and his fraudulent ideas about plant breeding. Mm-hmm. So that's basically how it happened. And so it was a class thing. It was also a deliberate political science move. To ignore those specialists, and then, you know, if necessary, if they didn't behave themselves, lock them up or execute them.
Well, I was struck by the fact that Vavilov persevered in spite of the fact that his comrades were being arrested. I mean, it seemed to take a long time for him to really accept that he was, you know, sort of next in line to be at least arrested, if not executed. I mean, so many of his colleagues fell in those last few years before he was arrested. I was stunned that he did not defect. I just couldn't understand that.
He simply couldn't believe that in the end they would see reason, and they would see the scientific fact. And they would come around to his way of thinking.
And it just never happened.
He simply didn't believe it.
So the man who wanted to feed the world was the man who died of malnutrition in the Stalin prison system.
That's correct.
Yeah. I'm going to wrap this up here, and I thank you so much for being on the show with us. But my last question for you was this. In the end, how much did Vavilov accomplish for the world and for Russian science?
Well, I think that, you know, the legacy is... first of all, the idea of seed banks.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we have the new one in Finland now.
We do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some of the seeds that existed in his original seed bank in Leningrad are in that seed bank in Norway.
Yes. Oh, it's in Norway. Right. That's right.
The so-called doomsday book. But, I mean... You know, he wasn't somebody who didn't produce any great theories like Mendel and Darwin or anything like that, but he steered the world's plant breeders into a certain direction by saying you have to go to these five centers of origin that he used to call them, of where those special genes come from for these crop plants. You have to go and collect them, and then you have to put them in the seed bank. So that basically is the legacy. You know, he left with them this idea that you've got to do it on an international basis. It's got to be done global.
Uh-huh.
You know, people weren't thinking about global anything in those days.
No, certainly not. I mean, it was sort of every man for himself in a way.
That's right.
Well, the interesting legacy to my mind, in a way, is that even though Vavilov's ideal was to feed the world, he sort of gave rise to what in the end has become the Monsanto monster, where plant genetics have become a matter of finding that highest yield and then forcing people to plant that.
Yeah. Well, how long have you got, Katie? We could go on about that one.
Well, you know what? You're going to come back, I hope. When your ankle is better, I hope you'll come out to Roberta's and you know, be in the studio, and we can get really busy with this whole subject.
Okay.
Because
okay.
Norman Borlaug died this year,
I
wanted to bring that up with you, but I unfortunately have to move on. So I want to thank you again. And the book, once again, folks, is The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov, The Story of Stalin's Persecution of One of the Great Scientists of the 20th Century. It reads like a thriller. The author, Peter Pringle, has been our guest today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Katie.
I look forward to having you again and again on the show.
Yeah.
This was really an honor.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Yep. I'll meet you sometime.
Yes, absolutely. Next time you come. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We are sponsored today by our friends at Hearst Ranch. And we are engineered by Nat Wiener, produced by Jack Inslee. And our first guest was Peter Pringle, the fabulous journalist and author of The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov. We had a lot to talk about there, and I'm hoping that he'll come back. And now we're going to turn our focus to the grocery business. My guest in the studio today is David Grotenstein, who I've known for, got to be about 30 years.
Yeah.
I date myself horribly, but there
it's
you go.
Almost 30 years.
Yeah, it's got to be. And David is now the director of operations for the Garden of Eden.
Yes, I've been there 4 months, actually.
And you were you at Fairway before that? Or did
Fairway
you
was kind of my alma mater in the food business, and I went back to Fairway.
Fairway
I was
for
Fairway
a long
from 86 to 94.
Yeah.
I was a specialty foods manager for them.
Right.
So I've been, and I started with you at
Pasta and Cheese. Back when Henry Lambert was rocking the world.
They were kind of pioneers, really. Yeah. You know, not so much in retail, but in they developed the modified atmosphere technology that all the fresh pasta you see.
Well, one of the things they did that I thought was so smart in terms of marketing was having us cut pasta right on the floor where people could see us doing it.
Right.
It was an incredibly tedious task.
But somebody had to do it.
And it really brought people in to the store. And then they the merchandising, the way they set up the stores, the sort of luxurious quality to the way all of the stores looked, no matter how crummy
the
little hall was.
The theater, the theater of food then and now and continuing, although it's a little bit of a challenge now these days.
Well, there's a lot more competition, and it's become what you and I were talking about earlier before we started the show was the fact that the so-called gourmet food has become very much of a mainstream operation.
And gourmet has become a very overworked and misused word, and
well, now people use the word foodie, which really makes me gag.
Yeah, that's kind of, it's a little too Sex in the City for.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. I just think it's bad grammar and bad, and even worse nomenclature. Right. I mean, it's like a foodie. No, I'm not subscribing to that.
A food enthusiast. And more than anything else, appreciative. That you go into a store. You're in any metropolitan area, but almost anywhere now, you go in and that you really appreciate the privilege of eating, and that you understand that you have all this tremendous food at your fingertips.
This incredible bounty of product from all around the world.
Right.
And, aside from the carbon footprint that we all get so worried about, at least we did last year when the gas prices went up over $4 a gallon.
Right.
Now it doesn't seem to be as much of an issue, I notice.
Right. And, of course, it's not an issue very much for New Yorkers, I suppose, and other cosmopolitan types who do all their shopping on foot.
Yeah, or through Fresh Direct.
Yeah, right. They have the carbon.
Yeah, they've got
a massive carbon footprint.
Massive,
I would think.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about the Garden of Eden, which is one of the more interesting chains that has grown in the last, as you said, 20 years.
Yeah, they're.
That was news to me. I was not aware that they'd been around that long.
First store has come and gone. First store was over
on 23rd
Avenue
and 3rd.
Right,
and I remember
that was
that
the
one.
First store.
Yeah.
And then they have actually five stores in the New York metro area. There are three in Manhattan. Manhattan, one on the Upper West Side where we ran
yes,
into each other.
Right, right and, across the street from my house.
Right, and in Chelsea on 23rd Street and yes. near Union Square. And then there's one in Brooklyn Heights and another one in Hoboken as well. And so, you know.
And that's a family run business, right?
It's a family run business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a Turkish family, as I understand.
That's right. Yep.
And what's, I sometimes hear that they're not so easy to work for, but I guess they certainly are smart guys.
Because
they've done a beautiful job of merchandising that store.
Having been in the food business for a long time, that being easy to work for has not been, in my experience, based on anybody's ethnic or cultural background.
It's like you either do the job well and they like you, or you don't and they don't.
Right. I've been in many places where if somebody's not yelling at you, you've had a good day.
Yeah.
So I can't attribute it to anything other than a certain entrepreneurial type, I think,
it's a high stakes proposition. Yeah. I mean, when you're bringing in inventory that costs what their inventory costs, I mean, let's face it, this is not a ShopRite. This is not, Kroger's. Mm-hmm. This is high-end food, very nicest quality of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah,
they have gorgeous meat. We have a new butcher in the one at 107th Street.
Yeah.
He's adorable.
Oh, yeah.
He's
doing a great job, too.
He's
terrific.
And he's a real butcher, unlike having somebody who's just kind of like taking the stuff out of the cryovac.
You're hitting on the interesting challenge these days. And, you know, as people's belts tighten, which is happening to everybody.
Sure.
Although the economy, I don't think, is a factor necessarily for where people are hurting at certain peaks, high-end tiers in the food business, yes, but everybody's eating, everybody's got more people actually are cooking at home than eating out, and so it's a good time for food shops. But how people perceive you and what they think you do can be critical. So for us, I would rather not be perceived as a gourmet shop or as a specialty shop or as anything like that. I really want the everyday customer to come in and see Cisco, the butcher, just the way you're saying, because we carry good stuff at comparable prices, but sometimes
are comparable prices.
Yeah.
They're really not bad. And sometimes there's some real deals there.
Yeah.
And it's very nice quality. Where do you guys get your meat, actually?
We have a handful of wholesalers that we work with around town, fairly closely, and most of the shops do their butchering on premises. They'll work from prime cut, so we're not just getting prepacked stuff and throwing it out on the stand.
Right.
You know.
And, I was trying to get at that because I think that makes a big difference. I mean, in terms of, again, you and I were talking earlier about the challenges that the meat industry is facing in terms of their public relations and how people perceive whether or not food is safe.
Right.
I think it's very reassuring to people to know that a grocery store chain is actually buying their stuff from specific sources that they have vetted and that they have an expert on premises who is evaluating the meat and making sure that all of the cold chain is pursued and that there are no pathogens.
We had calls
entering
the other day about the ground beef that was recalled, and the people want to know if what they got from us is okay. And you say, we grind it ourselves.
That's right. And, it's just another lesson in knowing where your food comes from and being familiar with who you're buying it from.
Right.
So, and that's one of the reasons why I like having on, people like you who can talk about these smaller businesses in New York. They're not part of a national chain.
Yeah.
They have a very personal and vested interest in the quality of their products.
Right.
And you might pay a couple cents more, but really overall the level of quality is so much higher that it's worth it.
It's the challenge. That's the thing, is that we have the one thing that we have to provide is the quality of the product and the service in the store that others have come into town and are providing alternatives for New Yorkers. Whole Foods is a huge player in New York now. And
I think that's so interesting. I mean, I was going to say, who's your biggest competition? Then I thought, well, obviously it's Whole Foods.
It is in some spots. You had somebody from West Side Market on. They're a competitor up on our Upper West Side store.
They are. They're a little more. I mean, I love West Side Market. I work with them a lot. I think they're a great outfit. They are a slightly different demographic, and they have a slightly slightly different philosophy.
It's hard to believe that only in New York could somebody be three blocks away
and have a different demographic,
but they
are. And they're, you know, they have a little bit of a different philosophy towards what they're doing. I mean, they want to be a little more sort of price conscious. They want to offer more of the deals, and they have a,
you know, they don't, in, for example, the 110th Street, they don't, they have a fish counter, but they don't have a service butcher in the
store. That's right.
All right.
Exactly.
So, you know, and you are who you are, and all you can do is you can't compete by imitating what others are doing or saying that's a better way. You really have to understand what your own core values are, what it is you're trying to achieve, and presenting it in a way that's really obvious to your customers. I think that's where a lot of people fall down, is that they're doing something really interesting in the store, but what that is exactly is not communicated successfully to the customers.
Well, and also something like Westside is trying to be more of a broad line marketplace where you can buy, you know, household cleaners and, you know, plastic shopping bags, you know, garbage bags and stuff.
We're little.
Garden of Eden does not do that. You don't have the space. And I don't think it's part of your sort of mandate. It's your identity.
It's times like these, I think, are a real opportunity for smaller, full service neighborhood stores like ours. And I had been a couple of years prior to coming to the Garden at Union Market in Park Slope. And they're a really good example of somebody who's really captured the neighborhood. They have two stores at opposite ends of Park Slope, and they're little stores. They're like 2,500 square feet, but they're full service, and they do great. They just really, they really address the needs of the neighborhood. You know, you want to be responsive to your customers and provide whatever it is that they need, and that's something that often is difficult to achieve in a larger store or in a larger chain, just that personal edge, you know, that really makes a difference.
Well, and also creating an identity that is really is distinct.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
say the Garden of Eden identity, which for better or worse is one that's associated with sort of a somewhat higher quality and a somewhat pricier, you know.
Well, there's the separation. That's the, you know, how do you separate the quality from that, that pricey notion, you know, that you have two product groups. You have products that are expensive, and then you have products that are overpriced, and that's different. And sometimes a lot of people think something is just you're being charged too much for something, and that can happen. You'll walk into there are certainly the more discount places. You know, people. You know, you go into a Costco. I mean, you have to buy 40 pounds of something, but you know, your Paul Newman's salad dressing is so much cheaper than it is almost anywhere else you can buy it. And people wonder why, you know, they come in and make the comparisons. Sometimes they're...
Let's talk for a minute about how a smaller chain competes in terms of their buying power with a chain that's huge, like a national, like a Kroger's or even a Wegmans or something like that, that, can buy in greater quantity, can distribute it more efficiently and probably more economically than you guys can.
Well, price-wise, it's almost impossible to compete. You can't, you cannot get that kind of, on perishable items, I think it's actually... might be a little easier than on, you know, grocery items. You know, people have warehouses. They buy container loads, pallet loads. They buy all kinds of things. We have our combined square footage for five stores is this, you know, wouldn't be the size of a Wegmans.
You don't have a central warehouse.
We did. You know, it's funny. We did prior to my coming there, and I'm there just about 4 months now, and we did have a warehouse operation that we decided to shut down. Actually, that it wasn't paying off for the kind of personal attention I think each store needed, and that each store wanted to give to the particular customer base in each neighborhood. And because you're buying from afar, you're not necessarily in touch with the inventories in the store. You're buying with this kind of even hand for every store, when in actuality from neighborhood to neighborhood one item might sell well, might not sell so well in another store.
I was going to ask you if there's a big difference between the stores in terms of the product that you stock.
There are some subtle differences. You know, you have some neighborhoods where you know, like in the meat department, for example, where you know pork sells less well than in other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You know, it just happens. But, you know, it's not, to me, it's not the way to, you know, I suppose when a chain gets really big, you have to work in some kind of dictatorial way. But for me, I would much prefer that the stores and each department within the store really take charge of their own inventory and the management of their inventory, and that they, you know, for our kind of the new way we're conceiving the centralized purchasing, is that it's just to provide, you know, the shopping list for everybody. Say, look, here are the products we would like to carry. Here are the people we would like to get them from. And, you know, as you suggested a minute ago, that, you know, even though we're a small chain, you want to make as much use of your buying power as possible, which means that you decide that you're going to get one item from one vendor. The stores had been buying kind of independently. So, you know, we could be buying the same product from five different people, or...
Mm-hmm. Or you could buy a lot more of it from one guy and get a better deal.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's, so you want to make that,
So who are the distributors that you work with? You work with all the usual suspects?
Yeah, all the usual, just
Cisco,
about everybody.
Baldor.
United. A little bit. Cisco, I think, not so much. United Naturals is big for us. Mm-hmm. In grocery, like Steiner and Nassau Candy and people like that.
Are you able to buy stuff from local? Do you do subscribe? Is this chain able to subscribe to sort of the locavore craze?
We're not, you know, it's part of what, you know, I hope to do. I don't think it's been in the psyche that much, although we are starting to, you know, cheese is a topic.
I have noticed that you have a lot more New York State
cheeses. And we're starting to, yeah, I have distributors now looking for me locally. Actually, there's one distributor up in the Boston area who's put together a New England program for me, so we're starting to bring.
Is that Sid Wainwright?
No, it's a company called Sheila Marie Imports, who's now part of Atlanta Foods International, and so they're giving me a new program every week for New England cheeses that we're bringing into the store.
Nice.
This week I'm doing a cloth bound cheddar smackdown between Cabot and Grafton Village. Both of whom are producing now cloth benches. I'm part of what I do is I'm a chair of the judging for the American Cheese Society.
I know we should talk cheese for a few minutes too. Yeah.
But that particular subcategory of cheddar has grown so dramatically over the last couple of years that we had to create a separate subcategory within cheddars just for cloth bound cheddars. And in fact, that's broken down into two subcategories dependent on the age of the cheese.
Wow.
Because the characteristics change so much. But everybody's wants us to carry these cheddars, and, you know, they say mine's better. No, yours is better. So we decided to leave it up to the customers. We put them both out.
We'll have to have a little cheese tasting sometime. On that same note, the other day I actually was in Garden of Eden in my neighborhood, and I purchased a Bufala Taleggio, which was really lovely.
That's a fairly new import. Yeah.
Yeah, I've never seen that before. I've actually never seen it anywhere before. Of course, you were sold out of it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. I'm glad and sorry to hear that.
That's all right. You had a regular Taleggio that was in perfect condition.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's a blended cheese. I think 60-40 Buffalo to cow, if I remember correctly.
It was fantastic.
It's nice. Yeah,
yeah, it was really a really nice texture, very nice flavor.
Nice.
So yeah, you guys have a nice counter. I mean, the thing that bugs me about the cheeses, especially American cheeses, why are American cheeses more expensive than the imports?
The
dollar is weak. I mean, you would think it would be.
It's a very logical. It's the same reason that it's because most of these cheeses come out of small batch productions, and they're really farmstead and artisanal cheeses, and so they're just more expensive to produce. A lot of our the cheeses we grew up with, one of the things is I walk into a lot of stores and I see the same lineup of cheeses that I've been looking at for 15, 20 years.
Absolutely.
They're all distributor driven and
You see them at the fancy food show when you see like these giant French distributors who come in with exactly the same lineup.
And they're very, not to disparage, they're very worthy cheeses, but there's nothing new necessarily about them. And in the meantime, many of these cheeses are made in larger cooperatives, and so the milk sources. And in fact, it's an intriguing area for a lot of us in cheese, is that how do they do it? You know, we know that they, how does a protected cheese, an AOC cheese, get enough milk to provide for the world market it succeeded in commandeering? You know, that now everybody buys Morbier. Everybody buys, you know, it's all over the place.
Actually, the two cheeses that really stick out in my mind in that terms of that are the ones, the one that's called Rocchetta and Latour, which are both Italian cheeses. And they're, I mean, they're absolutely fabulous cheeses. They came on the market just a few years
ago.
They're relatively,
relatively recent.
But they are world distributed.
Yeah.
They're made in large batches, but they have a very artisanal quality and feel to them.
That's
and they certainly produce the taste.
Yeah.
And I was, I've always been really curious about that particular co-op, because it obviously is a big co-op, how they manage to keep the quality that consistent when they're producing that much cheese.
And it's ongoing. You have to, if let's say your dream comes true and you, you know, you get all this business, what do? You have to constantly find new milk sources or work with farmers who are capable of increasing their production. So getting back to your initial question is that it's not, you know, somebody's got a farm with 15 cows is, you know, that's what they're doing. And there's no, the motivation may not be there to grow the business in that way to bring costs down because you're producing the quality of the cheese is the only importance, you know, that it has, nothing else matters. Nothing else, you know, for, you know, one of the things we notice, you know, in the judging is just because you go through the motions of, being artisanal or farmstead or whatever it is doesn't automatically mean that you make a good or great cheese.
Definitely
you
not.
You know, you still have to. So that's what's the most important. So once you find your formula. And I would say also, you know, we sell, the cheeses sell. They do sell. People, I think people in that tier, it's like somebody who's buying an $80 bottle of wine versus somebody who's buying a $12 bottle of wine. People understand the nuances. They understand the differences. The story, the romance of the cheese helps, but it doesn't, you know, it's really secondary, you know, frankly, to what somebody goes through to make a cheese. How's the cheese? And, you know, for me, it's actually the most exciting and interesting area in all of specialty foods right now is the emergence of American cheeses.
Cheese
they're
makers,
really,
yeah.
It's really like new food.
Oh, it's a huge new trend. Actually, one of the people that I'm hoping to have on via phone in a few weeks is a woman from the Narragansett Creamery in Rhode Island, because they're producing about six different cheeses. They took over an old mozzarella factory. And they're now, they give classes in cheese making when the farmers markets are done for the season in November. They're giving classes. And she said, we can't keep up with the demand. And I know that Ann Saxelby and Shauna Pacifico, who's been a host here many times from Back 40, and a few other people went up to Jasper Hill and took a cheese making class there.
Right.
So it's clearly, you know, for people who are interested in cheese, clearly this is a new trend.
Right.
And just, I mean, it's all part of this whole DIY thing, which I think is just fascinating. I mean, everybody wants to be able to make their own beer, make their own hard cider, make their own cheese. I mean, do the, and the butchering classes. Last week we had Tom Milan on from Brooklyn Kitchen Labs, who's going to be running the Meat Hook there, and he's giving classes in butchering. And I'm thinking to myself, now what consumer... You know, I mean, I learned how to butcher because I worked in a butcher shop.
But you're not exactly likely to buy a side of beef for home.
I'm not taking home a quarter of a cow, you know? It's just not happening.
Don't sell yourself short. You don't know.
Yeah,
you
may
one day.
I could take some refreshers.
Well, the thing to do would be get a group and do that.
Yes,
you know?
And then divide up your meat. It's true.
But I think what this is going to provide, you know, you know, we associate, you know, we're a very big country and we associate cheeses and other food items with their countries of origin, and the United States is kind of too big for that. And I think the great strength here is going to be in regional and local development. Whereas, you know, the customer that would come into the store and describe some European experience that they had, where they visited some small town, they went to this small market, and I picked up this little goat cheese and whatever, and they describe it to you, and they say, "Can you get it?" And you say, "No, of course not." You know, it was made for that. It was made to be consumed, you know, 10 miles from where it was produced or
That's
whatever
right.
it is.
It wouldn't survive the trip.
But
for
now we're seeing that. I think the green market movement over the last two decades has really contributed to people's awareness.
Yeah, I see a lot more cheesemakers in the market than I ever did before. Just in the last year and a half, I've noticed a lot more people coming in with their own cheeses. It's great.
And it's the same. It's like all the local growers. And so that opportunity now and that awareness, again, it doesn't necessarily... there's no automatics. It doesn't mean that because something is local, it's better or whatever it is. It's one of the pitfalls, actually, of being a producer like this is that you're subject to, you know, the weather one summer or, you know, whatever it is. So maybe it turns out, maybe it doesn't. But generally, you know, the freshness is everything. And so plus whatever practices people are putting into place. But again, that awareness and that demand is there, and it's there in every category in the stores.
And so to go back to the whole question of like whether or not the Garden of Eden is able to respond to that, and also how distribution affects that for you guys, because the thing about working with most distributors is that it's kind of a challenge to find distributors who are working with local farmers. Yeah. And I think that's been one of the biggest, shall we say, challenges in changing food. And what we were talking about earlier, which is if we can get everybody to participate, then everybody's boat is floated, because the prices will go down and it becomes more accessible. Whereas now, you know, local foods and artisanally raised this and that and produced whatever, it's prohibitive for most families.
Well, and I think
certainly it is for me.
As through the 90s and I guess the O's or whatever you call this last decade, you know, there was a people wanted to grow. I don't know what it was. Growing the business, being bigger, became this mantra. And it really, you know, for what you're describing, the opportunity, like for us as a smaller retailer, the opportunity is there for somebody who is a smaller focused distributor. You know, you've got not just one distributor, let's say, but many distributors will have almost the same line of goods, you know. So all anybody's really doing is competing on price. They're competing on service. You know, somebody's box of Carr's table water crackers isn't any better than any or fresher than anybody else's. Right. You know, it's just a question of price and what can I put it out for. So very often a larger distributor is not equipped to deal with somebody local in that way. So it's actually the opportunity for somebody to set up some smaller distribution network that is locally based, and to have a modest business that's successful, probably easier to manage as well.
I would think so.
And then provide for this real need and the desire that the customer has for locally produced product.
And support local agriculture in a way that is meaningful.
That's really meaningful, absolutely.
To the people who own that land and work on it. Because, I mean, no matter what business you're in terms of agriculture and food production, there's nothing easy about producing food. Absolutely nothing. I mean, as somebody who cooked for a living for 20 years, I mean, you work your tail off.
Yes.
You really do. Yeah. And that starts right at the farm. I mean, it's just there is not one aspect of the food business that is for the faint of heart or people who don't like to really work hard and
that's
physically
right.
hard.
Yeah. They're entrepreneurs. Everybody's on their own. Everybody is self-dependent on themselves, you know, and whatever quirkiness is going on in the marketplace, you know. We're seeing new cheeses every year. This year, with the recession, everything in the competition, you know, we had record number of cheeses this year. We thought that we would be over 1,300 products in judging competition this year.
That's fabulous.
So the movement is still there. The faith is still there.
Yeah.
And the best part of it is that because it is competition, but you know, for at least the cheesemakers, the dairy producers, it's friendly competition. But the standard keeps going up because you can't be mediocre anymore. Because there's somebody else out there who's going to look better than you. So everybody is taking more care. And so it's not just the number of cheeses that we're seeing, but the quality of the cheeses that we're seeing as well continues to...
That's very exciting, I think, because people are really getting... They're going to Europe, they're getting an education. And even American cheesemakers are starting to educate new cheesemakers. And I think it's a neat new field in the United States, which, you know, before it was like we produced dairy in Wisconsin and that was pretty much it. Everybody who had dairy cattle just milked them and sent their milk to Wisconsin.
And it's interesting. You know, we're very... I don't know if this is the American saga, but we're very, we're big and there's a lot of people here and we're very commodity based in the way we produce things. Although we're seeing again now in Wisconsin and, other states, the emergence of lots and lots of small and intriguing producers. We're seeing new cheeses and new flavors of cheeses, you know, they remind you of something, but you can't really call it something or pinpoint it as anything. And they'll tell you, I was inspired by abondance or comté or something like that, but it's really got its own flavor because it's
a new cheese. Because it's American milk.
It's a new cheese with new milk, exactly.
It's American terroir.
Yeah.
Because that's where you're really, I mean, besides wine, cheese is really where you taste the flavor of the earth.
Really, that's a real thing, yeah.
That ends up making the milk taste a certain way and makes it react a certain way to the cheese-making process. One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, in an ancillary sort of question to the cheese-making thing was, a couple of years ago, I reviewed a compendium of American farmstead cheese makers, and one of the themes that cropped up over and over again as the author described these dairy farms was that the reason that these people had gone into making cheese was because the dairy price supports were not working for them, and it was a way of making more money off of their milk instead of selling it into sort of the commodity market. And I know that this year, for instance, over 500,000 dairy cattle were slaughtered just in the Northeast region because the price supports for milk were so low, and these farmers could not make a buck on their, they couldn't afford to feed the animals anymore.
Right.
And so they were making more money by selling them as meat.
Uh-huh.
and I just was curious about why, I don't really know enough about the price supports or the pricing structure for the dairy business. And I thought maybe since you're in the grocery business,
I don't actually know either. I can't help you out that much. I mean, I know what the farmers tell me is that either they produce too much or too little milk for milk.
But we buy milk from overseas as well.
Hmm.
I mean, that's what I've heard, is that what's happening is that the country is buying the big processors or the big commodities, the big dairies like, I don't know, Highland Farms or, are buying milk from other countries, and that's driving the price of American milk down lower.
I know in the cheese business that people are buying curd. You can buy curd. A lot of frozen curd comes from elsewhere. Especially goat cheese producers.
Uh-huh.
Cheese Society this year asked people to take a pledge. All your cheese has to come from American sources.
Yes, I think that's important. Yeah, if you're going to be an American cheesemaker, you have to be reflecting our soil.
Yeah, but so we asked the cheesemakers to take a pledge that they were using all American products. And for us, that includes all of North and South America. It's not the...
We're not just continental.
Yeah, so Canada, we have a huge number of Canadian entries.
Sure. Well, the Canadians have a huge dairy or a huge cattle population. So,
but for the smaller producer though, I don't think a big dairy producer is a competition for a smaller producer. You know, they're making a completely a different product. They're appealing to a different. Segment of the market, a more demanding or sophisticated segment of the market. So whatever might be going on in a broader sense of the
dairy
industry would be impacting on what somebody was making. They're making an expensive product anyway that is going out to a customer who understands the value of the product,
right?
And they continue to sell. It's easier to sell an expensive cheese of quality than a mediocre cheese at a kind of high price, or something that's in that $12 to $15 pound range is a harder sell than a cheese that's really good that's over $20 a pound.
Yes, that makes sense to me. Because, after all, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
Well, David, I guess I hear from my boys out there that my producer and my engineer, Nat Wiener and Jack Inslee, that we only have about a minute left. So I'm going to say thank you so much for joining us today on The Main Course.
Pleasure.
My guest has been David Grotenstein from the Garden of Eden and a former almost lifer at Fairway.
Right.
And somebody who has grown up just like I have in the specialty food trade, and really I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
All right.